Well. And so we meet again. Hello, love bomb. Oh, how I've missed you so. Each and every one of you. The space to call on you. The ability to blast my thoughts into the ether. I've missed this. And so the day has come for me to reach out. I want to begin with, I'm sorry, it's taken me this long. The two seasons of The Love Bomb were and are some of the greatest work I've ever created. It's what I am arguably most proud of until now. I realized pretty quickly in recording this podcast that I needed to take the space to figure myself out, to put the pieces together of my own story, to decipher where I fit into this puzzle of life. And so the day has come. The book, Space Between, my own love bomb episode as written in word. I wanted something you could hold. First came the poetry. All of it is you, all of it is you, all of it is you, all of it is you. Then came the book. And so how do I introduce you to said novel? Please, universe, take care of me. I pray for myself and pray for my family, my lovers and strangers and enemies. Shine light down on me so I could properly see. I pray in the name of love, not this, not that, beyond definition, me. So I've always said that this book is not like the Dave Matthews Band song, Space Between. But it's not the Dave Matthews Band song. As I was trying to figure out exactly how to introduce this book to you, I went and looked up the lyrics. And oh my God, they couldn't be more perfect for this. You cannot quit me. You cannot quit me so quickly. Is no hope in you for me? No corner you could squeeze me. But I've got all the time for you, love. The space between. The tears we cry as the laughter keeps us coming back for more. The space between. The wicked lies we tell to keep us safe from the pain. Will I hold you again? These fickle, fuddled words confuse me. Like, will it rain today? We waste the hours with talking. These twisted games we're playing. We're strange allies with warring hearts. What a wild-eyed beast you be. The space between. The wicked lies we tell that hope to keep us safe from the pain. Look at us, spinning out in the madness of a roller coaster. You know, you went off like the devil in the church in the middle of a crowded room. All we can do, my love, is hope. The space between. So y'all, the book is out. It officially came out September 17th, 2019. Space Between, Explorations of Love, Sex, and Fluidity. And there's also an audiobook. Obviously, I recorded it myself. I mean, you really think that I was going to be out here letting somebody else tell my story? I want y'all to hear a special excerpt. I want to introduce you to this book in the way that inspired it, through audio. This book would not exist without the love bomb. This book would not exist without each and every one of you. This book would not exist without Will Malnati and At Will Radio. And I will always bend a knee and bow. I love you. The book is available on Audible. It's available anywhere books are sold. The audiobook is available on Audible. And I'm excited for y'all to hear it. So without further ado, here it is. Space Between. Pick up your copy, y'all. I love you. I love you. I love you. All of it is you. The space between everything is love. The space between everything, all of it, is you.
I was devastated after Gabriel and I broke up, but I didn't really allow myself to properly grieve him. Instead, blanketing any sort of remorse with antidepressants and alcohol. I'm not sure I gave myself the room to really grieve any of my past relationships. So that hurt and loss lingered and built up. I just kept pushing through, going on with my life, partying and looking for work. Even the visit with my dad, which had felt so important, so healing, soon faded from memory as I succumbed to the spirits that were haunting me. One thing about drinking is that it doesn't allow you to move through your emotions. And that's kind of the point for an alcoholic. The quickest way to lower your vibrational force is to drink. In one way or another, alcohol has been used to keep people in a lower state of consciousness for thousands of years. I still wasn't really ready to call myself an alcoholic, even as the pressures of my life kept intensifying and it was becoming more and more obvious that I wasn't able to deal with them. The common misconception about alcohol is that we think we're consuming it, when in actuality, it is consuming us. Not long after I sent Gabriel the email, I booked a part of Josh on Younger and moved back to New York. I was living in a sublet apartment on 28th Street, and it had the worst energy I'd ever felt in any place. It was drowning me. Bethany and their girlfriend had been seeing each other seriously for over a year, and when I wasn't working, we were all partying together. We started throwing these epic blowouts, wrangling a solid group to join in on the debauchery, and one night, a friend gave me some ketamine. Now, I was used to blowing white powder up my nose at that point, so when I saw the lines spread out on the table, I was under the impression it was cocaine. False. Later, I stood in the hallway of my apartment building for what seemed like hours, trying to get the key in the door, and for the life of me, I couldn't. That was the first and last time I made that mistake. It was around then that I decided to start drinking and getting fucked up alone. I didn't feel like I could trust myself around people anymore. I didn't even want to be around people. That's how deep the shame was. But ever since the fight I'd had with Ashton during The Beautiful Life, I'd sworn I would never let partying interfere with my work. And I didn't. I got into a routine of going on 3 or 4 day benders, going to a Korean spa to sweat it out for hours, and then doing the couple of days of shooting for the show each week. I would wake up in the middle of the night, hungover, and just start chugging booze. My apartment had a fire escape that led to the roof, and I would go up there at night. And for the first time in my life, I started having real thoughts of suicide. But even those thoughts didn't really touch me. It was almost like they were coming from someone else's body. And that's how numb I was. Completely numb for the first time in my life. It was worse even than being in pain, angry, or heartbroken. I would wake up in the morning and start drinking, knowing that I'd stay holed up in my apartment alone all day unless Bethany came to check on me. They were really the only person I'd allow to see me in the aftermath. This is when Bethany really started noticing there was a problem. I started getting really flushed when I drank, like my body was rejecting the alcohol. When Bethany talks about that time, they say things like, "I started to track how you were drinking, how you were sneaking drinks when no one was looking, or how your eyes would begin to lose focus." For the most part, I was pretty good at keeping my shit together and my behavior a secret. But Bethany always knew I was blacked out before anyone else did. Bethany was maybe the only thing that really helped me get through it. But those mornings when I woke up and reached for vodka like it was coffee to try to get drunk before all the shame and guilt set in, there was this part of me that was whispering, "This isn't you. Your life is to love. Your magic is your power. You have got to love yourself." It was like I was reaching out from 6 feet under during this time, trying things to get my body clean, even while I was pouring poison into it. I went to the spa, tried cupping and acupuncture, was revisiting old herbal remedies and superfood concoctions that I hadn't taken in years. I knew my old magic was still there, buried underneath the numbness. I just didn't know how to get it back, how to hold it in my hands long enough to actually do something with it. And even if I had, I can't say that I thought it would be worth it. I was mostly single during this time. There were a couple of short-lived relationships that didn't even seem real to me now because I wasn't real. I couldn't bring myself to sleep with anyone. It felt like poison. I felt like poison. The next couple of months are a blur. I'll spare you most of the gory details. I mean, you get the point by now, right? But you do need to hear the story of my rock bottom. It was December 2014, and shooting for the first season of Younger had just wrapped. The last scene I shot was when my on-screen girlfriend, Liza, comes out to me while on ecstasy as being 40 instead of 26. My character on the show was a mess about the whole thing, and that didn't help things for me. After shooting, I went on a bender and called someone from Craigslist to come to my apartment to do my hair while I was fucked up. Rocco flew into town and joined in on the festivities. I got motherfucking beyond culturally inappropriate dreadlocks. Don't ask me why, okay? The whole process took 7 hours, and that same night, my brother and I showed up to the Younger rap party totally obliterated. I'd never been really fucked up around any of my coworkers from the show, and I was showing up with this new persona, some douchebag white guy with dreadlocks, so unlike me that people didn't even recognize me at first. I still just needed to escape myself. I ended up bartending the party, and the next morning I woke up with my scalp on fire from the tight locks. I screamed for Rocco to find the hair clippers. And in the kitchen, just like when I chopped off all of Starlet's hair, Rocco shaved my head. But not in, like, a cute way at all. We were both hungover, maybe even still drunk, and I wound up with bald spots, holes in my head, and a bag of expensive-as-fuck multicolor dreadlocks. That was my last day in the sublet, and Rocco and I had planned on renting a car to drive down to Florida to see my mom and stepdad's new house for the first time. They had left the California life for tax-free, Republican, gun-toting Florida the month prior. So there we were, packing up the apartment, somehow managing to convince a rental car place to give us some keys, and starting the 17-hour road trip down south. Fuck my life. Rocco and I were in Florida for 2 weeks, wasted the entire time. We got into epic fights with our mom, our stepdad, and each other. I ended up threatening to call the police on all of them at one point. It was fucking horrible. From there, Rocco and I flew to California. I had to be in Pasadena with the cast of Younger for upfronts. In the television industry, upfronts are gatherings where television network executives preview their upcoming series for advertisers in hopes that they'll buy ad space during the new shows. All the major advertisers and press attend. I was out there on Younger's dime, and I took major advantage of it. My best friend from high school came out, and we started partying hard in the hotel room, draining multiple mini bars. We invited tons of people over, and at one point, someone hired strippers. Now that I'm thinking about it, the times I've been the worst, Rocco has always been there. I like to think I can handle partying the same way he can, so I'm always trying to keep up, but I just can't. And part of the reason for that is that Rocco is having fun and wakes up in the morning with a million-watt smile, wanting to tell the stories from the night before. I wake up full of shame and guilt, convinced I've somehow ruined everyone's lives. There were a bunch of up-and-coming actors, quite a few years younger than me, partying at the hotel. Folks I should have been a role model for. I embarrassed myself in front of all of them, though I don't remember exactly how. I was a mess. At one point, I fell and hit my head really hard, and pretty quickly everyone left. The party was over. When I woke up, from the bottom of my soul, I wanted to die. But I just kept drinking, alone, in the hotel room. I was supposed to check out that morning, but couldn't. I actually couldn't leave the hotel. I was trapped there, and I didn't know how to get out. I remember stalking naked around the room, slamming my head into the marble walls on purpose. The walls had literally closed in on me as I sprawled on the bathroom floor, surrounded by piss and blood from where I'd hit my head. I managed to call Rocco to come help me, to get me out of there. And when he showed up and found me, he went into panic mode. I was so far gone that later he told me that I pissed on him while he was trying to get clothes on me. He still talks about it to this day as the worst he's ever seen me, even throws it in my face when I bring up his addictions. I'm not as bad as you were, Nico. I racked up a bill of more than a couple $1,000s and wound up getting scolded by the network for my behavior. I said I would pay for it. They wouldn't let me, but told me if it ever happened again, there would be a problem. I had a flight back to New York that night for the Hunter and Game premiere, and I packed a bag that had one sock and a t-shirt in it. I went from JFK straight to Bethany's apartment and crawled into bed with them, hysterically crying and shaking, and they took care of me. My mustard flower. Somewhere along the way, I had lost both my wallet and my phone. Living the Hollywood dream, y'all. I knew I was beyond repair when I woke up, unable to stop shaking my head. I was screaming, "I can't stop doing it. I can't stop doing it. I can't stop doing it." And I wanted it to be done. That was it. Fucking done. You've maybe heard that AA cliche, sick and tired of being sick and tired. That's what happened to me. I never went to AA past a couple of meetings, though I think it's safe to say I've been going through all the steps in the last 4 years, and writing this book is one of them. Bethany and I went to the premiere of Hunter and Game, the film where I'd played Carson, the drug addict DJ. I had 3 tequilas that night because I had the shakes from withdrawal, and I said to Bethany, "This is it. I'm done with this shit." The next morning, I went to see Jamie, who had been living in New York for years and running a raw food restaurant in the West Village. I got a full 7-day arsenal of juice cleanses from her place. I also bought a copy of A Course in Miracles, which is an everyday affirmation practice. And it worked. Finally. For real. It worked. I've been sober from alcohol since that morning. Thank all the gods ever imagined. I have to tell you, I am so fucking grateful I'm done talking about this period of my life. I found myself spiraling even just finding the words to make sense of it all. It's so much easier for all of us just to forget and never have to relive any of the shit that we've done, but that was never an option for me. Not then, not now. Alcohol is what led me to all the other chemical-based intoxicants, and alcohol has always been the spirit I had real issue with. Cannabis, for instance, was a spirit I never really battled, so I didn't have to let it go. I call my sobriety fluid because I still use cannabis and other plant medicines. Everyone's recovery is different. There is no right or wrong way to get sober. For me, it's about staying healthy and maintaining control. I mean, let's be honest, most of us are under the influence of something, whether it's caffeine, chocolate, marijuana, or any number of over-the-counter or prescribed medications. Very few people aren't using anything to help them get through. I haven't overcome my issues with addiction. I have just substituted healthier choices for the truly toxic relationships. The poison. A week later, I moved back to LA to find more work, as I had no idea what would happen with Younger, and the professional coast-hopping cycle continued. It was good to be back in California, the land of the sun. My numbness had gone away, practically overnight, the second I got sober. I had honestly wanted to die, and now I demanded to live. My emotions came rushing back, and they were amplified. For a few months, I went raw again. I did yoga every day. I started listening to myself intensely, remembered who I'd been when I first moved to LA. I started making so much art out there. I had to make up for lost time. When I look back at it now, I can honestly say that sobriety is what birthed my queerness as I understand it today. Life was too short, and suddenly I had no fucks left to give. I no longer felt held captive by the limitations of Hollywood. The interplay of fame culture, materialism, and addiction are so obvious to me now. When I was able to really be myself, it felt less important to be the person they wanted me to be. I needed to figure out who I actually was underneath it all, because the ways I'd been halfway hiding had almost killed me. I rediscovered the wisdom that storytelling can be a way to heal, and I started making and telling the real story of myself. My physical appearance started to change significantly. I dyed my hair a new color every few days, got my nose and nipples pierced, got more tattoos. There's something undoubtedly queer about taking ownership of your body. Tattoos and body modifications as forms of art are vehicles for storytelling, a way to journal our experiences permanently. In this world's power structure, one that wrongfully dictates our bodies are not solely ours, tattoos and piercings have the ability to mark individual property. I started wearing whatever queer-looking shit I wanted to premieres and press interviews. I wasn't technically out publicly, but my appearance changed so drastically that my team totally flipped out and told me I was going to ruin my career if I didn't tone it down. At one point, they even hired a press coach for me just to cover their asses. This was 2015, y'all. The same year the United States finally legalized same-sex marriage in every state. Just let that sink in for a second. Not the wrong body, but the wrong world. Instead of listening to my team the way I had when I was 20 and cut off all my hair, I said, fuck it. I went on the Playboy radio show and talked about sexuality and gender, though I didn't officially come out. To try to understand my own story, I started documenting my own life in a serious way, filming almost everything. I had come up with this plan for a documentary, and Nico 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 was born. Nico 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 is an expression, an evolution of my artistic existence. It's a lifestyle brand. An unpredictable beating heart, a way to organize my curiosity, and I'm a pretty curious dude. I filmed the documentary with my brother in LA. It opens with me getting Nico 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 tattooed right above my hoo-ha, and then follows me for 24 hours in LA while I'm existentially spiraling. Everything that had been in my spirit just became art. I was healing myself through storytelling, becoming myself all over again. Rocco had told me that he'd stopped drinking as well, but he started showing up to work drunk and the project totally fell apart. In only a couple of months, I looked very queer, was being perceived as queer, and had started thinking as queer. Suddenly, I wanted to know more, to get educated, to learn queer history and language. The history of my people, of who had come before me, and who had, in a lot of ways, made me who I am. I started having real discussions with my friends and people I looked up to about navigating a queer conversation publicly. The first person I called was my friend Jeremy O'Harris, who's this radical black queer playwright, artist extraordinaire, a person whose life experience was entirely different from mine. But he's a wickedly smart, flamboyant, mad genius, and I knew he would have an answer to just about anything. We sat in my apartment for hours as I asked question after question. How the fuck did we all get here? And what do I do with it now? He really started me on my queer education. He told me who to follow on social media, which journalists to be reading, which movies to watch. We talked about everything I thought I knew and everything I didn't, and weighed the pros and cons of publicly coming out. Jeremy began to tease out of me the things I should say and the things I shouldn't. He encouraged me to begin to use my voice for change only if I was up for the commitment. This isn't something that just happens and is done, Nico. This is forever. Obviously, I'd been dating all kinds of men up to this point, but my understanding was really limited. I'd been operating in this kind of closeted, half-closeted mode, and my relationships with men had ended in part because I hadn't been loud and proud about who I was. Then I started dating a bisexual, queer man. He also dated a lot of women, but he wasn't trying to hide and pretend he was heterosexual when he was with a woman. He was always unapologetically queer in the way he acted and the way he looked, not ashamed of anything. And he actively didn't want people to think he was straight. Why the fuck would I want that? Was his attitude. I wanted to know everything. And not just the shit that had already happened. I wanted to know what the world hadn't imagined yet. 4 months after my sobriety and my transition, yes, that's what it was, into queerness started, my team sent me the script for an HBO show called Mama Dallas, written and directed by Mike White. It was a show about trans women and drag queens living in Texas. I don't think the script would have been sent to me if I hadn't started being who I actually am, and reading it blew my mind. I'd never seen a project like it before, and I wanted it more than any other part that had ever come to me. Casting wanted me to read for one of the queens, but after I read the script, it was the closeted redneck boyfriend of one of the women that I wanted to play. I figured I could work a lot of shit out doing this, and I got it. I flew to Dallas to shoot the pilot. As it turned out, my friend, La Demi, was in town for BeautyCon with the trans trailblazer Gigi Gorgeous. I'd first met La Demi in LA when she was only 16, already fierce and ferocious on the scene. That was before she had started to really transition, and even meeting her then, I never thought of her as having been born male. It just didn't make any sense. She was this Latina bombshell with enough bleach, spray tanner, and makeup to blend right in with all the LA girls. We were at a party once, just after I met her, and I flipped on her friends for still using he/him pronouns to refer to her. I remember us cuddling on the couch, and I looked her in the eyes and said, "You know, we're going to be best friends forever, right?" We hadn't seen each other or talked in years. But the fact that she was in Dallas at the same time I was shooting this pilot was just crazy. And I was elated to spend time with her. I picked her up from her hotel one rainy afternoon, and we went antique shopping. I'd been shooting, and I was in full-on redneck drag. Boots, hat, jeans, really getting into the part. Wearing this costume full-time around Dallas. I'd been surrounded by queens and trans women and non-binary people. I didn't even know what the word non-binary was then. It was like for a week, and I was really feeling myself. Coming into my own in the part of this closeted character as the real me was working on finally coming out. Bethany had lived in Dallas for 3 years, so I knew there was this big rodeo in Fort Worth. Somehow, I convinced Demi, Gigi, and a gaggle of girls from the show to jump in a truck and head to the motherfucking Texas rodeo. Fort Worth is about as Texas as you can get. And the stockyards and rodeo show is where the people gather. The building is more than 100 years old, and the people who attend are exactly who you would imagine. This is the heart of America. The blood is about as red as it gets. 2 hours of bronco riding, bull riding, calf and cattle roping, barrel racing, and trick lasso with me in full cowboy garb and a crew of the queerest, hottest people you've ever seen. Everyone clocked us. We obviously stood out amid all the Wrangler, Stetson, and Walmart. And just as the entire stadium stood up to cheer, Demi grabbed my hand and pulled me down next to her. And in that sea of cowboys, we were just a boy and a girl staring into each other's eyes. We both leaned in at exactly the right time hidden from the rest of the world. And ever so softly, we shared our first kiss. To our surprise, most of the people were actually really great, taking pictures with us, telling the girls that they were beautiful. A few older men got really nervous and said some shitty things, but there were enough of us that it wasn't a real problem. The courage it took all those femmes to show up in a place like that was unprecedented. I was able to be a bystander and hide behind this hyper-masculine male drag, but to witness this crew unapologetically being their queer selves in a stereotypically unsafe space was fucking epic. It was fuel. On the way back to the hotel, Landemi reached over and grabbed my hand. It was a really beautiful moment. Not necessarily romantic, just us saying that we wanted to be there for each other, to hold space for each other. And that is exactly what Landemi and I have done. Mama Dallas did not get picked up, which is the greatest heartbreak of my career so far. It was just a year or two before its time, and this is even after Joe Biden announced to the country in 2014, when he was still vice president, that the trans rights movement had reached its tipping point. HBO wanted Mama Dallas to be campy. But Mike was like, no, this is about real people with real lives and real emotions. And HBO ditched the show. But the greatest thing that came out of the experience for me was Landemi. We started hanging out a lot in LA. She was heavy into the party scene, so I wasn't going out with her. I mean, sobriety stuck so hard, so good. But I lived in downtown Hollywood, and she'd come to crash at my place after a night out. The first time she came over, I was like, hey, I'm too soon into sobriety to really have sex with anyone. Landemi looked at me and said, honey, that is not what is going on here. No, 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 ma'am. Then she looked around at all the weird trinkets and art and the altar in my apartment and said, by the way, bitch, this apartment is trans as shit. You are trans, baby. When are you going to realize that? Of course, we wound up sleeping together for the first time about 3 days after we said we weren't interested. It was like after it was off the table, we were free to explore it. It was absolutely some of the most incredible sex I've ever had. Landemi hadn't technically started a medical transition yet, but sleeping with her was more like sleeping with a woman than sleeping with any designated female at birth woman had been. Her feminine energy was cosmic, like the embodiment of the divine feminine, something far outside or beyond the bullshit of socialized gender. It was this divine awakening for me. It is so important to note here that one does not need to medically transition in order to be trans. I repeat, a person does not need medical intervention in order to be recognized as trans. Every person is entitled to their own journey, no matter what it looks like.